Good evening. This is a program about one of the most serious crises of the Vietnam War, a crisis that could be the last crisis. There are this evening just under 3,000 Americans left in South Vietnam. Large numbers of American Marines were put on airplanes in Hawaii today, and President Ford says the Marines in the area of Vietnam are being sent back to bring Marines there up to strength. He also said the Marines are not going to Saigon, but quite obviously the Marines in the area could be sent to Saigon to bring out those 3,000 Americans. And the movement of the Marines came on a day when the president of South Vietnam, Nguyen Van Thieu, quit his job, using extraordinarily brutal language about broken American promises, which means that South Vietnam is presently without a genuine government, with three-fourths of its land in the hands of the North Vietnamese and the Viet Cong, along with perhaps half of its population. In other words, it's a mess. And if you look at the map, you'll see how dangerous it is militarily for Saigon. This part of the map is the Central Highlands, which have been lost since the fighting began up in here in March. This line is the extent of the communist advance in South Vietnam. Today, the South Vietnamese lost Dzuon Loc, which opens one pathway to the capital. The big air base at Bien Hoa this morning, Vietnam time, came under shell fire again. There is enemy movement around Tay Ninh here to the northwest of Saigon. Here in the delta where the food for Saigon is grown, the North Vietnamese and the Viet Cong are on both sides of Route 4 and are moving closer. There was one report of shelling just 16 miles south of Saigon this morning. So what we have is we have Saigon encircled by about 10 communist divisions with wetlands here that would make very difficult avenues for attack, but dry country along here through Bien Hoa and along the banks of these rivers. And should the enemy decide to exercise its option for attack on the city, the route would be along here. We talked with John Hart of our Saigon Bureau this morning about the situation there, and he said there has been a feeling there that the Viet Cong and the North Vietnamese could have made a move to capture the city whenever they wanted to, but he thinks they've been holding back. I also asked Hart about the feeling in Saigon now that there may be chances for a coalition government instead of a battle for control of the city.
There is a great hope among the intellectuals and politicians we've been talking with that this might happen. But in the last few days, that hope has turned to despair.
That was before President Thieu's resignation. There may be a little more time now, but whether it would be immediately a new kind of government, a coalition, or eventually, there is almost universal resignation among the selected politicians and people we've been talking to toward an ultimate communist state all over Vietnam. All of those illusions of 2 weeks ago, all of the pipe dreams that they clung to, are gone.
Nguyen Van Thieu's resignation as president of South Vietnam was accompanied today by a denunciation of the United States which is probably unparalleled in the history of this country and its relations with its allies. For South Vietnam is still an ally of the United States, despite the departure from office of Nguyen Van Thieu. The customary bland manner of Thieu was replaced this time by deep bitterness and by some tears. Thieu said, if the Americans don't want to support us anymore, let them get out. And he said that the United States had led the South Vietnamese people to death. He used the words betrayal and broken promises. Thieu likened the promises of more military aid from the United States to the promises made a smoker who wants a cigarette now but is promised a carton in 5 years. He said, to our people, if you can hold this carton for 5 and 10 years in front of me, what does that mean to me? He continued, the communists know this, so all they need is to escalate their attacks to gain military victory without the need of negotiation. When you saw our people being lost, he asked the United States rhetorically, why didn't you come in and help our people? You signed the Paris Agreement, which said you would do this. In accordance with South Vietnamese law, Thieu named the vice president, Tran Van Hung, to succeed him as president. Ung was once mayor of Saigon. He was once prime minister of South Vietnam in 1968. And he went home today and wept over the problems facing him. Ung is an old man now, 71, enfeebled and nearly blind. And the problems he faces now could very well induce more than tears in this old politician whom you see being led to the podium by President Chu. He is also the first civilian president South Vietnam has had since the association of Ngo Dinh Diem in 1963. Ung had ambitions for the presidency in the past. He ran against Chu in 1967, but as expected, the vote went overwhelmingly against him. He's an intellectual. He began his career as a teacher and a school inspector, and during one period of semi-retirement, he wrote books of poetry and essays on Vietnamese opera. He is not likely to last long as president of South Vietnam. Ung is expected to resign and to be succeeded by a man named Tran Van Lam, who is 10 years younger and much more vigorous. Lam is now the president of the South Vietnamese Senate. When the Paris peace agreements were reached, Lam was foreign minister, and he signed those accords for his country. President Ford was interviewed tonight at the White House by CBS, and he made these points about the situation in South Vietnam. The initial beginnings of the South Vietnamese rout, said the president, was the failure of Congress to supply adequate military help to Saigon. The president said the United States is talking to a number of governments about the possibility of settling the conflict. There has been no opportunity yet, he said, to make contact with North Vietnam because events are moving too fast. And, Mr. Ford said, no one in Washington ever put any pressure on President Tu to resign, although Tu may have been talked to by Americans in Saigon.
Our government made no direct request that President Tu step down. There was no pressure by me or anyone in Washington in that regard. There may have been some on the scene in Saigon who may have talked to President Tu, but there was no pressure from here to force President Tu to step down, and he made, I'm sure, the final decision all on his own.
I'd like to ask our White House correspondent, John Cochran, about those remarks of the president this evening. John, you're there at the White House. My reaction to what the president said was that somebody in our embassy in Saigon may have talked to Tu about stepping down. Would that be your impression from what he said?
That would be exactly my impression. My impression would also be that the man's name is Graham Martin, the ambassador to Saigon, who enjoyed very good relations among the Americans in Saigon with President Tu, and there weren't a great many Americans in Saigon in the last few months who did get along with Mr. Tu. It sounded to me that the president was saying that Mr. Martin called on President Tu on one or more occasions and pointed out to him the advantages and disadvantages of his staying on the job. And that Ambassador Martin fell short, however, of saying, we wish you would step aside.
Well, Ambassador Martin was really, as you say, quite close. Is that speculation on your part, just for our record here this evening, John?
That's speculation on the part of some White House aides here who have seen some of the cable traffic and who may be reading too much into that. But they say that from looking at the cables, that is their impression.
And so that the president is able to say this evening, quite truthfully, that no one in Washington talked to President Tu, but we now believe that somebody in our embassy in Saigon may have given him the word.
Yes.
That really is short of ousting him or dumping him, as the word is.
Well, I think the president pointed out that it all depends on how you use the language.
Thank you, John.
Thank you.
More than 1,000 Americans got out of South Vietnam today as the American airlift speeded up because of the rapidly deteriorating military situation in South Vietnam. There are just under 3,000 Americans left in South Vietnam now. The hope is to get that number down to 2,000 in a day or two and finally to 1,000. We have reports on this from Bob Flick and Don Oliver.
The evacuation operation started very slowly with a lot of confusion. Some planes left this base in the Philippines, went to Saigon, and returned without passengers, apparently because the evacuees weren't assembled. Here at Clark Air Force Base, a host of greeters, Red Cross, family services, and immigration people. But this plane was only half filled, 66 people, in a C-141, which could handle up to 200. The first arrivals were mostly American contract workers and their Vietnamese wives and children. The men work for American firms under contract to the U.S. or Vietnamese government in Saigon. Many said they left Saigon reluctantly because family relatives had to be left behind.
The corruption in the Saigon government is apparently continuing right up until the last. The evacuees coming in here complain bitterly about large bribes that they had to pay to Vietnamese officials to get Vietnamese nationals out of the country.
The whole thing is based on how well you know who you can pay to get something done. This is the way it works. And yesterday, after I sat at the theater, Tansinut, all day, trying to get papers processed through the American side, we get all the way to the last station, or next to the last station, of Vietnamese immigration, and that dirty, anyway, said, cannot do. We don't handle adoptions here.
While they are waiting to be processed to go to the United States, the evacuees are being housed in barracks here on the base. As the numbers increased, officials began making plans to erect tents to house the overflow. 2,000 had arrived by midday on Monday. At the same time, the first evacuees to be processed, after President Ford issued the evacuation order, boarded a plane for the United States. 217 people, bound for Travis Air Force Base in California. Don Oliver, NBC News, Clark Air Force Base in the Philippines.
209 got out on this flight. Some were military, some civilian. There were a large number of Vietnamese women, wives of Americans, and 37 of their children. Some among the passenger list charged that those with money get out, those without money stay.
The people that are paying for this is the Vietnamese wives of Americans, other representatives of other foreign governments. They're paying quite a bit of money to get passports and visas and this and that.
What kind of money?
It ranges anywhere from 50,000 piastres to 2 million.
2 million piastres in American money comes to roughly $2,500 per passport and visa. How many, if any, paid to get out on this flight was not known. People got out with what they could, what they felt was important. The Air Force says evacuation flights will continue on a one-a-day basis until all Americans and their dependents are safely out of Vietnam. Bob Flick, NBC News, Travis Air Force Base, California.
There was talk about money in the Congress as well today, money for South Vietnam. The House Appropriations Committee voted $330 million in economic and military aid for Vietnam. We are not sure, no one is sure, if that can get through the House or the Senate, along with other measures for aid that have been passed by various committees. Catherine Mackin, who covers Congress for us, is standing by now in the midnight air outside the Capitol. Cassie, simply, will the Vietnamese get more money out of the American Congress?
Well, it looks like they could get some money to the extent that it is called aid for evacuation and some humanitarian aid.
What was the reaction on the Hill today to the resignation of President Chu?
It bordered on being ho-hum. People here said, well, it was inevitable. Some said it was long overdue. Sort of in that direction. But nobody seemed to be overly excited about it. In fact, nobody seemed to be excited about it at all. Maybe they're just numb from everything that has anything to do with Vietnam, from so many years of involvement.
And the administration is still trying for more of that aid. They did it today. Will they go on trying?
Well, late today, the White House, or people who lobby up here for the White House, were saying that there is a chance that the administration will try again tomorrow. And in fact, two Republican senators said this afternoon that they thought the administration would give it one more go. The final decision will be made tomorrow morning to try for some limited military aid.
And you'll be there covering it, Catherine. Thank you. Get some sleep. Radio Hanoi reported today that telephone and telegraph communication has been reestablished between Hanoi and the old imperial capital of Hue for the first time in 20 years. Hue is one of the major cities captured by the other side in the offensive that has seen 21 provinces lost to South Vietnam. Another city now occupied by the North Vietnamese and the Viet Cong is Da Nang. Over the weekend, Alessandro Casella, who is a Swiss specialist on Asian affairs, visited Da Nang. He then went to Hong Kong, and here is his report, along with film he shot on what life is like in Da Nang now.
Less than 3 weeks after the fall of Da Nang, the Viet Cong government invited a small group of Western correspondents to visit South Vietnam's second largest city. The correspondents were flown to Da Nang from Hanoi in a Soviet-made jet. The city of Da Nang did not suffer any damage from the war, because there was no Battle of Da Nang. On March 29, the Saigon army just surrendered without a fight. Life in the city today goes on as usual, but in the streets, Viet Cong soldiers have replaced Saigon soldiers. Children smile at foreigners, and the people look relaxed. The 100,000 Saigon soldiers captured in Da Nang by the Viet Cong have been released and can be seen in the streets in civilian clothes. The local market in Da Nang is bustling with life, and goods appear plentiful. The new government has rationed rice to issue an adequate supply to all. The rice is marketed through the wholesalers who traditionally controlled the rice trade in Da Nang. Viet Cong soldiers, assisted by local volunteers, guard all public buildings. Many of these volunteers are girls, and most are armed with American weapons. These volunteers are part of the former clandestine Viet Cong forces within Da Nang. Most of the schools in Da Nang are now open and classes have resumed. The children still use textbooks put out by Saigon, but these will soon be replaced. The teachers are also the same, but they now follow special courses to acquaint themselves with the policies of the new government. The children in Da Nang appear unaffected by the war. They look happy and well taken care of. The Viet Cong are making considerable efforts in the field of education. And one of their major goals, they claim, is to provide education to all. On the banks of the Da Nang Harbor, war is a distant memory as passers-by and Viet Cong soldiers relax in the evening breeze. However, on the outskirts of the city, the signs of war are ever present. The Viet Cong have not yet assessed the total quantity of American equipment that the Saigon Army has left behind. To protect their newly acquired wealth, the Viet Cong have installed SAM missiles. Alexander Casella, reporting for NBC News.
We've had the first reaction of the Viet Cong in Saigon, where they have a mission to the resignation of President Chu. They said it was a clumsy, deceptive trick manipulated by the United States in order to maintain the traitorous stooge Chu clique without Chu. They said it was a farce. We don't quite yet know what that means because the Viet Cong in Paris today were very cautious in their reaction. Richard Valeriani, who covers diplomacy for us in Washington and the Department of State, is in our Washington studio now. Dick, as you heard on the nightly news this evening, there was a report circulating in Washington today that Ambassador Graham Martin may be asked to return for consultations. Have you been able to check on that?
Matt, the report has been making the rounds at the State Department, John. But I talked to a top American policymaker tonight who said there is absolutely no truth to that report.
On the other hand, Dick, the Viet Cong have been asking that Chu go, and now Chu has gone. They've been asking that American military advisors, the civilians, go, and they're leaving by plane loads. Do you see any indication that, without saying so, that the conditions demanded that have been set up by the Viet Cong are being met?
That's quite a plausible theory. However, I think we should point out that the evacuation of Americans remaining in Saigon has also been demanded by a number of senators and representatives in this country.
Do you, when you talk to analysts in the Department of State, do they believe that the Viet Cong flag is suddenly going to fly over the presidential palace and that the Viet Cong and North Vietnam will take over all South Vietnam, or are there alternatives to that?
They feel that the Viet Cong will be allowed to take over South Vietnam, that the Viet Cong, the PRG flag, will fly initially, but that all the orders and directions will come from Hanoi, that North Vietnam will eventually try to reunify the country.
Thank you, Dick. See you tomorrow. In the last days of his presidency, Nguyen Van Thieu saw the prospects of more military aid from the United States grow more and more slender. And so he ordered the retreat of his army toward Saigon, a retreat which turned into a disorderly rout, punctuated only occasionally by his army's determination to stand and fight. Chu saw three-quarters of South Vietnam fall to the North Vietnamese and the Viet Cong. Garrick Utley reports on why all of this happened.
Why did this happen? Tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of refugees fleeing the Central Highlands at the start of the North Vietnamese offensive. They fled because the army did. And the army fled because it was ordered to. President Thieu gave that order. He decided it was no longer worth the cost, in money and lives, to hold on to the Central Highlands, which are sparsely populated and were already largely controlled by the communists. So Thieu ordered the army to pull back to the coastline, which is more easily defended. But the order was made too quickly, with too little preparation. Soldiers started asking, why are we retreating without a fight? Military discipline collapsed. In the confusion and chaos of the rout, soldier and civilian knew it was everyone for himself. At some places, the army set up checkpoints to control the human torrent, to restore discipline and order. But it failed. Da Nang was the last chance in the north for the army to stop the collapse and start fighting again. The city was jammed with refugees, more than a half million. And among them, soldiers who had fled from Hue. They should have been defending the city, but they were too demoralized. There was no one to organize them, to lead them, and they had left their weapons behind. And so, Da Nang was lost. With Da Nang gone, the collapse spread southward. Tuiwa, on the coast, was supposed to have been one of the key government positions after the army's withdrawal from the highlands. But now, it too would be lost. After days of disorganized retreat, with their families, soldiers were no longer a fighting force. They just wanted to get out. Of one armored division that left the highlands, only one tank and six armored personnel carriers remained when it reached the coast. The rest was left behind. The army's collapse had to stop somewhere. And it did finally at Vung Tau, a safe port southeast of Saigon. Refugees and straggling soldiers were brought here by boat. The soldiers were searched as they came off the ships, dazed and hungry after weeks on the run. They were told they were still in the army. The soldiers were taken to processing centers. Their names were taken down and they were fed. Then the job began of turning them back into fighting men, into fighting units. Garrick Utley, NBC News, in Saigon.
However, President Thieu's decision to retreat and the subsequent rout made that difficult, if not impossible. That decision was one of the things which ultimately removed him from office, although he had so skillfully found his way through the labyrinth of South Vietnamese politics. He became president. For more on Thieu, here is Jack Reynolds, who was long an NBC correspondent in Southeast
Asia. Nguyen Van Thieu was an army general who skillfully maneuvered himself through the succession of coups which followed the toppling of President Diem. In 1967, he became president. His chief rival, Nguyen Cao Ky, had to settle for the vice presidency. Soon, Thieu had cut off Ky's power base and was the undisputed ruler of the country. The Americans had almost 500,000 men in South Vietnam, and they were bearing the brunt of the war. Thieu and President Lyndon Johnson met in Manila during a conference which put forward several unsuccessful proposals for ending the Vietnam War.
We owe to those who have shed their blood for freedom and peace to take the concrete measure to ensure that their sacrifices will not be in vain. Thank you very much.
In 1969, President Nixon went to South Vietnam for a meeting with Thieu. The American withdrawal had already begun. Now, the Vietnamese were beginning to fight their own war. There was more talk of peace.
I wish first to point out that what happens in Vietnam, the kind of peace that we are able to achieve in Vietnam, will have an enormous impact on the future of peace and freedom in all of Asia. And so the stakes here, important as they are for the people of North and South Vietnam, are important also to all the people of the Asian area and, of course, the people of the world.
After the signing of the Paris Accords, President and Mrs. Thieu visited the Nixons in San Clemente.
Mr. President, we have been allies in a long and difficult war. And now, you can be sure that we stand with you as we continue to work together to build a lasting peace.
But despite the Paris Accords and the reassurances of President Nixon, the war in Vietnam went on. President Chu faced military challenges from the North Vietnamese and Viet Cong, and political challenges from his domestic opposition. One indication of how far Chu's military support had eroded occurred on April 10th, when a young Air Force pilot bombed the presidential palace. Chu and his family were unharmed. Chu's final attempt to stay in power was the formation of what he called a fighting cabinet, consisting entirely of people whose primary qualification was loyalty to Chu. But faced with certain defeat on the battlefield and a total lack of popular support, Chu finally, reluctantly, accepted the inevitable and resigned. Jack Reynolds, NBC News.
One is left this evening with thoughts about what Mr. Chu said today about broken American promises. It's very tough language. It is also hard to justify, in my view, when we think of what we invested in the defense of South Vietnam. 56,000 dead, 150,000 seriously injured, $141 billion, a crippling inflation at home, the decision of one president not to run again, the riots on the campuses, the revolt of a lot of young people. We made an enormous effort in Vietnam, and we kept our promises longer than most countries would ever have. We may not have won in the end, but whatever we felt about the war, no one can say we didn't try. I'm John Chancellor. Good night for NBC News.
This has been a special edition of the NBC Nightly News on the resignation of South Vietnamese President Nguyen Van Thieu.